Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Sara Silfo welcoming you once again to our regular program, Monday Memos from Concordia Seminary. As is our custom, I would like to give you a brief update on what's happening at the seminary, particularly in the forthcoming weeks that we have scheduled some special events. This Wednesday, November 5th, Dr. William Estep will speak at a convocation at 10 a.m. in Pritzlaff Hall. Dr. Estep is professor of church history at Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary, and the title of his topic is The Making of a Prophet. Dr. Estep has lectured in a variety of countries throughout the world and has recently published a book on Luther and the Anabaptists. Then the following Wednesday, November 12th, we will have as convocation speaker Reverend Walter Snyder, who will speak on ministry to American Indians. Reverend Snyder is well qualified to do so, since he has served for the past 9 years as pastor of a congregation in Gallup, New Mexico, a congregation consisting of mixed Indians and Americans. Let me emphasize again that if there are any in our radio audience who would like to attend these convocations, feel free to do so. They are held in Pritzlaff Hall on the campus at 10 a.m. On November 13th in the evening, we are conducting the semi-annual lay leadership meeting here on campus. If you have not received notification of this in the mail, please call the Office of Seminary Relations for details and for your reservation if you are interested in coming. Now, turning to today's program, we have in our studio today an individual who has been on the seminary faculty for more than a year now, Dr. David Daniel. Welcome, Dr. Daniel.
Good afternoon.
Today we'll have the opportunity to learn a little bit about him, but chiefly also about the topic for our discussion today, Martin Luther. We have just concluded observing the Festival of the Reformation in our churches and elsewhere, and so we thought this was a timely topic for today. Dr. Daniel, you are Assistant Professor of Historical Theology, is that correct?
That's right.
Okay. Before coming to the seminary here, what did you do and where did you come from?
I came to the seminary from Erie, Pennsylvania, where I taught at the Barron College of the Pennsylvania State University for 9 years.
9 years?
9 years.
And before that, I believe you taught at Concordia College in River Forest?
I taught at Concordia College in River Forest before I came to the seminary in the summer of 1978 as a visiting professor of Reformation history.
Mm-hmm.
Before Penn State, I was pastor at St. John's Lutheran Church, a Slovak Lutheran Church in Hazleton, Pennsylvania, and at the same time did graduate study at the Pennsylvania State University.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Slovak. Do you want to elaborate a little bit on that? With your name, I think...
Well, Daniel is a very Slovak name, although it doesn't sound like one. The Daniels are quite common in Slovak churches in America. There were several Daniels who were pastors. Slovakia, of course, is the eastern half of what is today Czechoslovakia. And when many of the Slovaks came to America around the turn of the century, they came from what was then northern Hungary. Many of them, of course, joined the Lutheran churches in the area. They were Lutherans. Not all of them were Catholic. And they joined the Missouri Synod in fellowship around 1905-1906.
Mm-hmm. Did you by any chance use the Slovak language when you were a parish pastor?
I used it a little bit. We had a very small number of Slovaks who still required the use of Slovak, but I had to learn it while I was a student in graduate school because of my studies, so I was not very proficient in it.
Mm-hmm. This is probably modesty that's speaking now. I don't normally ask this question, but tell me something about your father. I know him.
Well, my family, my father was from Garfield, New Jersey, and is a pastor, a graduate of Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. And it is still serving a parish in semi-retired status in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and was for quite a few years president, the last president, of the Lutheran Synodical Conference of North America, which was an association of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, the Synod of Evangelical Lutheran Churches, which is the Slovak Synod,
mm-hmm.
The Wisconsin Synod, and the Norwegian Synod.
Mm-hmm. For how many years was he president?
I really don't remember. I think it was about 6 years.
I see. Uh-huh. Okay, so we have established the proper connection here. That's good. I know you're not going to tell us about this, and I won't go into a great deal of detail, but as I look at your biography, I'm certainly impressed with the many publications which you have authored and the variety of topics on which you have spoken as well as written. And already in the short time that you've been here at the seminary, you've certainly made a terrific impact on our students and on the seminary community. Tell me, what is your special field? Now, I know you teach in the area of church history, but what's your specialization?
Well, my general specialization, if I can use that term, is the Reformation. Of course, for many, that's specialized enough.
Mm-hmm.
But we Reformation scholars like to get involved in all sorts of subspecializations. There are Lutheran scholars and Calvin scholars and Zwinglian scholars and Norwegian Reformation scholars, English Reformation scholars. Well, I, obviously, as a result of my background, study the Reformation in Slovakia in particular, and then more broadly in the area of Hungary and Bohemia, a little more broadly in the area of the Austrian Habsburg lands, with a particular emphasis on Luther and Lutheranism.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm probably a Lutheran Reformation scholar as it occurs in the Austrian Habsburg lands, and in particular the region once known as Northern Hungary and is now Slovakia. That's
okay.
Specialized.
I think we have everything down pat now. A question that I've heard people ask, and I think you're just the man to answer it. The Reformation happened way back when. We all know what took place. Why dwell on it? Why spend so much time on it now?
Well, the Reformation, of course, is a historical event and is probably more interesting to historians as an event goes than many people living today. Many people just like to forget what has gone by. But it's been said that you can't really forget history. It's there with you whether you recognize it or not. History is the consciousness of men. It's the memory of a society or a group. I refer to myself as a Slovak. I don't really speak Slovak fluently. I have been to Slovakia, but don't know much about the people or the traditions that are existing now, but I come from that heritage and somehow it has shaped me. So Luther shaped the heritage of the Western world, of the Western society, the way we talk, the way we think, the way we sing our hymns in church, the fact that we preach in English, in the language of the people, and read the Bible. All of this was shaped by the Reformation. Indeed, the hymns we sang on Sunday, A Mighty Fortress Is Our God, or Lord Keep Us Steadfast in Thy Word, these were written by Luther and have been sung by Lutherans for the 450 years since the Reformation.
Mm-hmm.
So we, really, the Reformation lives on in all the people who call themselves Lutheran.
Mm-hmm.
It's our past,
mm-hmm.
and it's also part of our present.
Yes. Did Luther have in mind to become a reformer? Was it his intent to change the world? How would you answer that?
Well, I think that's a really important question for us as historians to wrestle with, and I think important for people to consider in trying to evaluate the man Luther. It doesn't seem that Luther really wanted to reform anything, or at least change anything, to change the world. He only had some questions. He wanted, really, to be sure that God loved him,
mm-hmm.
that he could be sure of salvation. And yet, as he struggled with the way that was prescribed by the medieval church, that is, doing penance and searching out one's soul to find all the secret sins and then to confess them and to receive absolution, he just couldn't find comfort.
he couldn't really be sure that he had examined himself carefully enough, that he had found all the sins to be uncovered, that he had done enough good works to counterbalance all the evil works that he had done. He was left alone in the monastery to examine and to chastise himself. It was a part of the monastic system. And thus he became quite disquieted, as anyone would be in that situation. He was a pilgrim, in a way, searching for some surety. There was a man, John Staupitz, who he always looked up to, who recognized in Martin that there was a man who was very severely troubled because he was really and truly trying to be a good monk, a very good Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And so Staupitz recognized that Martin really needed to search the scriptures carefully. This was a little unusual. Monks don't normally read Bibles. They read their breviaries, but they don't read the Bible. So they sent Martin off to study the Bible. And it was as a professor, as he studied the Bible, he began to search the letters of St. Paul, especially the letter to the Romans, the letter to the Galatians. He also searched the Old Testament, the Psalms. And it's interesting, using those three books, he began to come to a whole new understanding of what God expected from man. As he looked at these texts, he saw in the Psalms the message of comfort. He saw in Paul the statement that a man should live by faith.
Mm-hmm. I wish at this point we'd have the time to go into some of the details about the Reformation itself, for instance, the nailing of the thesis to the door and so forth. But I think in order to save us a little time, I'm curious, how did the Reformation spread?
Well, as Luther found this new idea that the just shall live by faith, and by faith he meant a relationship with God. It wasn't something that you just knew or something that you did, but it was a living relationship. It changed the way people thought about the church.
Mm-hmm.
Doing good works wasn't the way you were saved. You were saved by faith. And this was something that people were yearning for. You see, what Luther had gone through, other people were going through at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And when they looked at the Bible, and when they read it, they saw there a church which was in no way the same as the church as it had actually existed then. And they began to criticize, and they found in Luther a leader. You can call him a hero of faith.
Mm-hmm.
And they began to flock to his teaching. Well, how did the teaching spread? Well, students flocked to the university. Wittenberg was a famous university with Luther there, and Luther was a popular professor. And they would go home, and they would say to the people, "We heard this at Luther's feet." And then they would buy books of Luther. The book printing press had just been invented about 25 years before, mm-hmm. the movable type, and Luther's books were bought. They were the best sellers of the day.
Mm-hmm.
So also the learned people of the day and the magistrates, the laymen, began to look at Luther and see in him something that they were not getting in the churches they were going
mm-hmm.
to, and they slowly began to adopt Lutheran ideas. And so it spread. It spread first around Wittenberg and then throughout Germany, and then it spread northward to Scandinavia, and then, of course, down south to Hungary and Austria and Bohemia, and even over to Transylvania,
mm-hmm.
where Lutherans were found early in the 1530s.
What period of time are we talking about? How long did it take for this to take root, to catch on?
It caught on very, very quickly. You must remember that Luther first posted his first major tract, the 95 Theses, in October of 1517. There was a little stir, but it wasn't only until after the Leipzig debate in 1519 that Luther began to write. He was called to the Diet of Worms in 1521, where he took his famous stance that he would not recant anything that he had written unless he could be proven wrong from Scripture. Well, just 9 years later, within 9 years, the cities and princes of Germany who had followed Luther stood up before the emperor, and together they did the same thing at the Diet of Augsburg that Luther had done 9 years before at Worms. We call that event, of course, the presentation of the Augsburg Confession.
Mm-hmm.
We just celebrated the 450th anniversary of that.
Yes, right. Uh-huh. I was just going to ask you next, how does this relate to the work of Martin Luther, the Lutheran Confessions?
Well, the Confessions were presented by, in many cases, laymen. Now, certainly, excellent theologians prepared some of them. Luther, for instance, wrote the small and large catechism, the small cult articles. Philip Melanchthon, who was a layman, and many people forget that, he was a theologian, but a lay theologian, wrote the Augustana, the Augsburg Confession, the Apology of the Augsburg Confession, and the Tract on the Primacy of the Pope. Three other theologians wrote the Formula of Concord, and this was accepted by laymen and theologians alike. And what's interesting is that the Confessions are a summation of not what Luther taught, but of what Lutherans believed. You see, what Luther taught was that the Scriptures, the Word of God, was the only rule or source or norm for theology, for the life of faith, that God had revealed himself in the Bible, and therefore, if we are to know anything about God, we have to search the Scriptures, and that anything we teach has to be judged by the Bible. And the Confessions state that. And they state it not only on the issues on which Luther had spoken, but on those issues which came up especially after Luther died. So that the Confessions are an explanation of what Lutherans teach and the reasons why they teach it, that is, the scriptural reasons why they teach certain things. They're a statement of the whole church, and that's why we call ourselves Lutherans, because this is the faith which all Lutherans confess, the faith defined in the Confessions.
Well, I'm interested in knowing how could the laymen of the church at that time be so well equipped and know their, shall we say, theology?
Well, it must be remembered that the laymen were interested in religion. It was an age of faith. Religion was still the common denominator of the society. Skepticism might abound a little bit in some of the universities, but on the whole, people took their religion very seriously. At the same time, many of the people now were reading. We have this idea that the people of the Middle Ages couldn't read very much.
Right.
But they did read. If we look at the sales of the booksellers, books were a hot item, and they were passed from hand to hand. They did have the Bible in their own language, and it was an innovative book. I mean, can you imagine the first time a man could pick up a Bible and understand it? It was in his own language. He read it voraciously. And of course, Luther helped the matter along by presenting that little Bible, in a way, the small catechism, a very brief book which can be memorized, and which many of us did have to memorize as part of our catechetical instruction. They learned their theology, and it's an excellent little compendium of theology. But they were concerned. They had a pastoral concern. And I think this is why they did accept the Reformation and why they turned to Luther, because they were concerned that people know what God wanted them to know and that they lived according to the Word of God.
Very good. I find that really very interesting. Now, you've spoken about Luther as a pilgrim and as a professor. What about Luther, the pastor? What was he like, for instance, at home? What was his family like?
Well, Luther, the pastor, was kept pretty busy. And his home life, well, it was hectic. It must be remembered that when Luther got married in 1525, first of all, he had no intention of doing it. There had been a cartload of nuns who had escaped from a nunnery who had been brought to Wittenberg, and Luther helped to find many of them husbands, suitable students or townspeople. But there was one troublesome girl, because she would criticize all those candidates Luther brought forward. One was too old, one was too young. And so finally Luther, in exasperation, asked her, well, who do you want? And she said, you. And thus it was that Katie von Bora, daughter of a minor German noble family, married Martin Luther. And they had six children and a whole household of guests, perpetual guests.
I had never heard that story before. So she did the actual proposing?
She did the proposing, and she did the managing, from what it seems, the documents. She managed the household. Luther was far too busy writing and preaching. He preached almost every Sunday and frequently every day during the week. He lectured, he wrote letters, he oversaw the affairs of the people in Wittenberg and throughout Saxony. He constantly had visitors coming and going, high-level delegations from Bohemia or the Netherlands or the South German states or the North German states had to talk to the honored Dr. Luther. And Katie had to feed them and had to take care of the children and also all those boarders that lived upstairs in the cloister.
He had no private office to escape to, I assume. This was all done in the home.
All done in the home. They had the living room and also a large number of guest rooms. Actually, they lived in what was once the cloister where Luther had stayed as a monk, and the Elector of Saxony gave it to them as a home. And so not only did Luther live there with Katie and six children, but also some nephews and nieces who they adopted to take care of. They also took in numerous students who were indigent and couldn't afford to live in the homes in the cities, and of course all those guests who needed lodging too.
Didn't he ever get tired of it?
Oh, I think quite a bit.
I would think so. What about Luther the father? Are there any interesting tidbits? I'm sure there are, but we don't have all that much time.
Well, Luther was a tender father. Sometimes when you hear Luther, at least in the mind, thunder forth in his sermons, you sometimes wonder whether or not he was a cold man. But he was a robust and humorous man, and he could write tender letters to his children. There's one letter that's preserved to his son Hans, when Hans was concerned about his father's being away. His father wrote him a little letter about the garden, and it's obviously a little allegory about the garden in heaven, but he talks in such childlike terms that children can understand him. His heart was also broken as a father, for he lost several children very, very young. Magdalena, of course, was one who caused him great joy and great sorrow as she died just as she approached her teenage years, and he lost another child in infancy.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is all extremely interesting. I just wish we could go on and on. You don't happen to have that letter handy, do you?
Oh, I do.
Could you at least read us portions of it, if not all of it?
Well,
I think we have enough time.
Well, it was written to Hans Luther in June of 1530. Grace and peace in Christ, dear little son. I am glad to hear that you are studying and saying your prayers. Continue to do so, my son, and when I come home, I will bring you a pretty little present. I know a lovely, pleasant garden where many children are. They wear golden jackets and gather nice apples under the trees and pears and cherries and purple plums and yellow plums and sing and run and jump and are happy and have pretty little ponies with golden reins and silver saddles. I asked the man who owned the garden whose children they were. He said, they are the children who say their prayers and study and are good. Then said I, dear man, I also have a son whose name is Hans Luther. May he come into the garden and eat the sweet apples and pears and ride the pony and play with the children. The man says, if he says his prayers and is good, he can come into the garden with Phil and Justy too. And when they all come, they shall have whistles and drums and fife. Then he showed me a fine large lawn and a garden for dancing where hang the real golden whistles and fine silver crossbows. But it was yet early and the children had not finished eating and I could not wait to see them dance. So I said to the man, my dear sir, I must go away and write at once to my dear little Hans about this, so that he will say his prayers and study and be good, so that he may come to the garden. And he has an aunt, Aunt Lenya, who he will bring with him. So, little Hans, study and say your prayers. Oh, and tell Phil and Justy to say their prayers, too. And study, too, so that you may come into the garden together. Well, God bless you, and give Auntie Lenya a kiss.
Oh, isn't that, that's really precious, isn't it? Well, how I wish there were more time, but in our final moments, could you sum up for us what you feel is the significance of Luther and the Lutheran Reformation today?
Well, it's awfully hard to do in 30
yes,
seconds.
Yes, I know it is.
But perhaps the best thing to say is that we walk in the footsteps of Luther. All who call themselves Lutherans walk in the footsteps of Luther and of Katie and of Melanchthon and of all the great reformers. For the Lutheran Reformation is our Reformation.
Thank you so much, Dr. Daniel, for being with us today. This has been a wonderful 25 minutes. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to our December Monday Memos from Concordia Seminary. This is Gladys Silflo, once more bringing you up to date on what's happening at the seminary in the coming weeks, and later on introducing one of the newest programs on our campus and the man in charge of it. As we look through the December calendar, we find that the first important date is next Wednesday, December 10th. On that day, we will celebrate the 141st anniversary of the founding of the seminary with a special service at 10 a.m. Preaching the sermon will be the president of the Missouri District, Dr. Paul Spitz. Then, as part of the service, two individuals will be awarded honorary degrees. Pastor Albert Marcies of Parma, Ohio, who is president of the SELC, the Slovak district, and another man who is very well known in the St. Louis area, Dr. Clarence Peters, who for many years was pastor of St. Luke's Lutheran Church here in the city. We invite all of you to come to this service and with us thank and praise God for 141 years of blessing on our seminary. Then a few days later, on Sunday, December 14th, we will have the annual Advent Christmas Vespers in the seminary chapel at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. The choirs will include the seminary chorus and the Pro Musica Sacra under the direction of Dr. Alfred Fremder. The featured work will be Bach's Christmas Cantata, For Us a Child is Born, with string and harpsichord accompaniment. Then after the concert, there will be a reception in Fritzlaff Hall with refreshments served by the Seminary Guild. Again, that's December 14th, 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Now, getting on with our program for today, we have as guest Reverend William Engfer, who is not totally new to you since he's been on this program once or twice before, but today he's going to share with us some very interesting and fascinating information. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you.
I believe you came on board here at the seminary in a full-time capacity in March of this year. Is that right?
That's right, Gladys. I accepted a call here in March to serve full-time as the seminary's director of educational media.
Educational media. That's the term that I have heard tossed around here on campus quite a bit lately. Or is it Concordia EduMedia Programs? I take it that this stands for educational media, as you stated. In 25 words or less, can you tell us briefly what this program is all about?
Well, Gladys, educational media is not really anything new to the seminary, but we're using a more expanded approach to it these days. And we have formed an agency called Concordia EduMedia Programs, which is a fancy trade name for the work that we're doing in educational media. This agency serves as the seminary's planning and coordination agency for programs of the seminary that use educational media. Maybe we should stop right here and say, what is educational media?
Yeah.
When we talk about educational media, we're talking about a lot of tools that help us in the communication process that we call education. We are very familiar with some of those tools. For years we've used a piece of chalk and a chalkboard. That's a tool that we could call an educational media tool. But of course today there are many more sophisticated tools that are available to us. And those range all the way from using cassette tapes and recorders and things like that, to using various projectors, movie projectors, slide projectors, that kind of equipment, as well as using television cameras and things like that also, all to help us in the process that we call education.
You have done very well in telling us and giving us a good definition of it. Where on the campus is this department located, and what kind of staff are we talking about?
Well, we're primarily located in two places, our administrative offices and our tape libraries and some of our video playback facilities and things like that are located in the seminary's library. Then in the lower level of Seek Hall, we have our production facility, which includes a number of television studios and all of the various other things that are involved in producing television programs and things like that for use here at the seminary.
Well, I'm going to interrupt you with a question right here. The cassettes, for instance, that are stored in the library, are they available to anyone who uses the library facilities, or is there limited use? Are they just for students, or what's the deal on that?
Well, we have over 3,000 cassettes in our collection, and those are available for use by anyone who is using the library. Many of them can even be checked out for a period of 7 days. They can also be requested for use by mail, and can be used in that way. The loan period there, again, is 7 days from the time the tape is received by the patron. Mm-hmm. So those resources are available. And in addition to audio tapes, we have a videotape library of over 350 titles. Now, those we do not circulate outside of the building. Those are for use on the campus. We have a number of rooms in the library where students and others can go to view a videotape. So we have that available also.
Well, I have learned something very new today. I was not aware that we had such an extensive cassette library. Is there any kind of catalog or any way in which people can find out what is available?
Well, at the present time, we don't have an up-to-date catalog. We're in the process of putting the entire library collection, books and cassette tapes and all the other things, onto a microfiche catalog. Which is kind of a new approach to distributing a catalog, but it will enable us then to have a new catalog available that will be updated every 3 or 4 months. So at the present time, we don't have a current catalog, but we do send from time to time little publicity brochures that list some of our newest selections available and things like that.
I see. Uh-huh. Well, we better get back to the subject that we started with before we go too far afield here. Getting back to the EduMedia programs, who runs these programs? That's not a very good word, but...
Well, this group works with what we call a council, and the council is composed of myself, the Director of Educational Media, and then several other people who are involved in a number of other programs on the seminary campus that at times have application in educational media. Those include the Director of Continuing Education, the Director of Graduate Studies, the Administrative Director of the World Mission Institute, a faculty representative elected by the faculty, and the Director of Library Services. So we have a very wide-ranging group. And mm-hmm. This council then meet on a regular basis, and they provide planning and coordination of many of the programs at the seminary that use these various tools.
I see. Uh-huh. I have to admit, Bill, that I guess because it's so new to me, that I don't quite know how these programs tie into the seminary curriculum. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yes. There's a number of areas that we work in. The first area, and the most important, we feel, is to support the classroom work here at the seminary. And that involves everything from seeing that a professor has the film or videotape that he wants to show, to helping him make overhead transparencies, to providing him with any kind of projector or map or anything else like that that he might want to use in the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
Then we also work in the area of continuing education. We have a number of programs there, some that use audio cassette tapes, others that use videotapes, and various other things in that area.
Now, there again, you're speaking of on-campus or off?
This would be primarily an off-campus thing.
Uh-huh.
These would be for pastors who want to continue their education And sometimes those are courses that offer credit, and other times they're just enrichment courses. We are involved in so much as these courses might use audio tapes or videotapes or some other educational media tool.
I see.
The programs are actually run through our Office of Continuing Education. Sometimes they're courses that involve only books, and then we wouldn't be involved with them.
Mm-hmm.
But at other times they use videotapes and things like that, and that's where our involvement comes in.
Mm-hmm.
So in the same way then, in a third area, we work with parish services. And parish services involve service to congregations, where we can provide the same kinds of materials geared for congregational use in Bible classes and things like that.
Is that used quite extensively, or is it so new that not many are aware of it?
Well, it is a very new concept for the seminary to be involved in this kind of work, and right now we're just getting underway with mm-hmm. this aspect of the work, so it will be a while yet until we have a large number of people using it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you've mentioned three distinct areas. Are there others?
Yes. Again, another area that involves many times off-campus work is the area of graduate studies. A number of our professors seek advanced degrees, and many of them begin that work at extension centers in other parts of the country that are run by the seminary. At times, those involve the use of videotape, where a professor's lecture material and other things are recorded on videotape, and the tapes are then played back at an extension center. In that way, men in the field can begin their graduate studies without traveling too far from their home.
Now, we have been doing quite a bit along that line, haven't we?
Yes. We began a program way back in 1975 that involved using five courses that were prepared on videotape. And they were played back in Milwaukee at our synodical school there. That allowed men in the Milwaukee area to come and begin work on advanced degrees.
Mm-hmm.
And that program was very well received. Several of the men who participated in that part of the program went on to pursue their degree full-time and ended up as students here on the campus at the seminary. So it was a very good way to get them started on the road towards an advanced degree.
Yeah, I should say so. Well, when you videotape the men here, again, I know I'm admitting ignorance, but do you take actual classroom scenes?
Well, at times we have used that approach where we've had a class meet in our studios, and we videotaped the class just the way it would be in the classroom. Sometimes that doesn't work out very well because there's a lot of extraneous noise by the time you pack 10 or 12 people into a studio. Sometimes the classes are even too big to do that way and to really capture the important material on videotape. So at other times we've had professors come into the studios and we might say speak directly to the TV
mm-hmm.
cameras.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way that really uses the medium best, because that way they have prepared the material especially with the viewer in mind, the person who's going to see the tape later on.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do you do, or how does this work when you then have it at the extension center? What if these men have questions?
Well, usually the way this is structured is the basic lecture material is presented on the videotape, and then the men are asked to do written assignments and tests and papers and things just as if they were on the campus. In addition to that, we establish a weekly or more often telephone set up where the professor calls them and has a discussion with them. And if it's a group of several, we oftentimes use a little telephone amplifier so that the whole group can sit and talk to the professor at once. So in a way, it's similar to being in a classroom, mm-hmm. except it's done by remote control, mm-hmm. if you want to say it that way.
I find that very fascinating. Well, I kind of sidetracked you here. What are some of the other areas?
Well, the other two areas that we work in are ministry to the handicapped and ministry to minorities. And again, as those ministries apply to the use of educational media. For example, in ministry to the handicapped, We are acquiring equipment right now that will enable us to caption videotapes for the hearing impaired. And what we hope to do is, first of all, produce some of our own programming with captions, Bible studies and things like that for use by congregations. An exciting thing in this area is that many of our deaf congregations have just acquired videotape equipment. They had some help from Synod's Board for Missions in purchasing this equipment, so they are now ready to play back videotapes. The problem is there's no material for them to play back. That's where we come in. Mm-hmm. We're producing videotapes that will have captions on them.
Mm-hmm.
We hope also to take some of the material that's already available, like episodes of This is the Life, and caption them so that they can use materials that are already available but are not available for the hearing impaired.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another area where we're using these tools as service to the church.
Mm-hmm. What would you say are the advantages of using the tools which you described for teaching? Some, of course, are pretty obvious.
Right. Well, I think one thing that's very significant, I think our most valuable resource here at the seminary is our professors' time. We have some difficulty, as you know, in finding men who are qualified to teach at the seminary and are willing to make the necessary sacrifices. And with the great blessing of our increased enrollment, this becomes more and more difficult. So anything that we can do to enable our professors to reach more students with the quality education that we want them to have is something that we're looking very hard at, and we're trying to apply many of these tools to that. For example, the Extension Center program that I mentioned earlier. Traditionally, we have sent a professor to a location, and he, over a period of 3 or 4 weeks, has taught one course. Well, by using videotape and preparing his material ahead of time, he could, for example, meet 2 days a week with the class, and instead of hearing his lecture, they would see his lecture already prepared on videotape. The third day, he could meet with them for discussion. He could then teach 3 different classes or 3 times as many students. And so we're really getting 3 times the work out of one professor.
That's a real energy saver if ever there was one,
right.
Isn't there? Did you want to comment anything more on that? I guess we've covered that sufficiently.
Well, I think that's a good example of how we can use some of these tools, really the importance of spreading our professors a little bit thinner, but keeping the quality and content of their teaching up to where it is now, and even better.
Yeah. As you were talking about this, one question that crossed my mind, do other synodical schools have a similar program, or are we the only ones at the present time?
Well, many of our synodical schools are acquiring new materials in this area and new equipment, but we are by far the leaders. We have one of the finest production facilities, the best among our synodical schools. So we kind of have the capability of serving as a clearinghouse. We can take a videotape that one school has prepared and transfer it to a different size tape or whatever is needed so that it can be sent to another school. So we have served in that capacity in the past as a kind of an exchange, a middleman, so that others can use these resources too.
Well, that sounds like still another added blessing that we have here. Bill, I heard you talk about using a computer to assist with instruction here on our campus. That one too, I have real problems with that. How in the world can a computer be helpful for theological education?
Well, I guess you have to know the computer.
Yeah, I'm sure.
We are working right now on a trial basis with a computer system that's operated by Control Data Corporation called the PLATO system. That stands for Programmed Learning and a whole bunch more. One of the especially exciting things about this is that this system has a library of courses that have been prepared by various people around the country. We can make use of that library here on our campus and in other places. For example, There is a course that was written some time ago and is part of this system on New Testament Greek. And so our students who need Greek have a number of options now. They can either take it in the classroom here, or we're beginning on a trial basis. In fact, it's starting today, where we have three students going through the program now, taking their Greek from the computer.
Is that right?
Right, and assisted with tutors and doing written assignments and things much as they would in class, and listening to audio tapes so that they learn how to pronounce the Greek language too. This is especially important because our Greek classes, as a number of our other classes, are very near capacity every quarter, and it's getting more and more difficult to fill the needs of our students. That's a nice kind of problem to have.
Right, yeah. Well, how do you think those three guinea pigs are going to fare?
Well, they seem to be excited about it, but
so.
we'll have to watch this carefully and see whether this is a good thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
We also have the capability with this computer to write our own courses, and right now we're working on a course in Biblical Hebrew. And that course is going to be designed more as a review and as an exercise course that will supplement the work they're getting in the classroom. It'll be something where the student can come and go through something he didn't understand and take the unit as many times as he needs to understand it and have a chance to be drilled by the computer. It will ask him questions and he'll have to answer them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very patient kind of machine. It keeps asking until he gets them right.
Oh, all this sounds very exciting to me. I see that our time is really slipping away fast, but what do you think the future holds in this whole area, Bill? In your wildest dreams, what do you envision as possibilities?
Well, I think I'll have to limit myself a little bit because I could go for a couple hours on that. But one thing that I think is very exciting is the great number of new pieces of equipment that are being introduced that are finally affordable, and people and congregations especially will be able to buy these. Especially the home video recorders that are on the market now and some of the hottest selling items this Christmas. They're now down in the $600 and $700 price range and certainly becoming affordable for congregations. People buy those initially to record TV programs so they can see them at a later time. But right after that, they get tired of watching Monday Night Football 10 times and they look for something else.
Mm-hmm.
We'd like to suggest that if there's some good quality Bible studies and other programs of interest prepared by our faculty and available on videotape, that may be a very exciting and profitable way to use these pieces of equipment. And that's just what we're doing right now. We're developing courses and we're going to be introducing ourselves into the so-called marketplace sometime in January, so that these materials will be available. And I see a tremendous future in reaching our congregations and allowing them to have the benefit of our faculty no matter where they are.
Yeah. No, I think it's very fascinating. I can envision all kinds of issues, current issues, for instance,
right,
that can be discussed on these. And it'd be a real crying need for that. However, in all of this, you don't see that the day will come that we will displace all our professors in the classroom, do you?
No, I think some of them are a little worried about that. Sometimes when I start talking and dreaming, they say, uh-oh, next he's going to have my job. But no, not at all. We really see these as tools, and just as any tool, you need someone to use that tool and to use it well. And the tool can only be as effective as the people who are using it. That means not only technically using it, but also those that are providing the content. And that's where our professors come in. We have no finer faculty anywhere. And what we're trying to do is to help them to do an even better job.
Yeah, in that connection, I think the people here in the area, and some of our listeners surely have attended some of these lay lectures. What I heard you saying before is if we could, for instance, use those and get them out to New York and California.
Very much. We certainly cannot afford to fly our men all over the country to do lectures and things like that, and we do that occasionally, but especially to provide this kind of material to people all over our church.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm just sorry that our time is up. I wish we could have started you early on your wildest dreams. We thank you sincerely. You have heard Reverend William Engfer speak about the Concordia EduMedia programs. Thanks a million, Bill.
Thanks, Gladys. It's been a pleasure to be here.